This will be a little bit different from some of the things that you've heard. And I love this quote for it because in some sense, I like the fact that... Did the earth move for you? Anyway, I like the fact that there's an element, there's sort of two types of science that I do and that I think a lot of us do. And one part of it is really associated with mathematics and getting numbers back. Mathematics and computation, it's precise, it's quantifiable, and yeah, you can argue about it, but the argument goes, I think you have a bug in your Fortran code, right? It does. And then there's another type of science, which is very important to chemistry, maybe slightly less important to physics, and certainly almost unimportant to mathematics, which is really trying to understand what's going on. And Professor Bickerhoff's talk this morning gave sort of a flavor of that sort of thing. Both of them, of course, are important. I'll talk about this understanding part and really trying to understand what's happening in chemical reactions and some tools that I've been developing together with some of my colleagues and friends on this basic topic. So speaking of colleagues and friends, this is the various people in the research group. I'm going to mostly talk about chemical reactivity indicators and things related to that. There's lots of other things that are more density functional theory, more electronic structure theory. Maybe if I was talking on the last day, I'd be talking about that instead. And basically, I should start here with the acknowledgement, but I'll sort of integrate it in. This stress sensor analysis of chemical reactions is something that Samantha Jenkins, back when she was a professor in Sweden before she moved to China, got me interested in. And basically, as many people do, she gave me a puzzle to figure out. And then Patrick Boltink has done a lot of work together with me on this information-based atomic partitioning, and a lot of collaborative with him. And then finally, Chen Wu and Inkai Zhang, we've been working on what I would call an orbital-free energy decomposition analysis. And those are basically the three things I'll tell you about today. As a little bit of motivation, I like these two quotes. Let's just go through the Mulliken one, which basically says, the more accurate the calculations become, the more the concepts tend to vanish into thin air. It was 1965, 30 years later, Head Gordon said something very similar. And basically what he's saying is a huge amount of our intuition is based on Slater determinants. But Slater determinants sometimes don't give very good answers, at least in the qualitative things. Even though, say, the Kohn-Sham orbitals are very useful, if you just evaluate the Kohn-Sham energy expression, just use those Slater determinants to evaluate the energy, you're by definition worse than Hartree-Fock, right? So I'm not going to say anything bad about orbitals. I'm just going to say it would be nice if we could get beyond the Slater determinant picture and come up with tools for understanding reactions that aren't limited to Slater determinant type pictures. And the first thing I'll tell you about is what I call the stress tensor approach. Basically, this is, you know, a picture of a molecule, and the normal way we would think about nudging or doing reactions is we would think about taking this oxygen atom and doing something with it. We imagine moving the atoms. But it would be totally equivalent, instead of imagining moving the balls in the reaction, to imagine moving the springs or the bonds that connect them. And so you could imagine taking a bond and tugging on it and seeing what sort of thing is happening. In some sense, this is reminiscent of the difference between, say, a force constant approach and a compliance approach, in the sense that the two of them are inverse in a mathematical sense. And so the question is, could we come up with an alternative perspective that had to do with how do we rearrange the bonds, not how do we rearrange the atoms? And that's what led to this analysis of the stress tensor, which is very, very old. Physicists seem to have started really working on in the electronic structure theory context in the last 5 or 6 years, but it goes back to work from the late 1970s and early 1980s from people like Bader and Epstein and Parr. Basically, there are two things you have to know. That when you imagine the stress tensor, it is a tensor, so you can think of it as a three-dimensional quantity. It has modes, it has eigenvectors. These eigenvectors have two types depending on the sign of the eigenvalue. Basically, one type is what we would call compressive, which means you're pushing in. that basically is the sort of attraction you imagine at the center of a bond. All the electrons are trying to crowd into the bonding region, and so a little cube of density in the center of a bond will have, perpendicular to the bond, electrons crowding in, trying to pull in to the bond and increase the density along the bond. And then the other style, which is the tensile ones, The tensile ones are the ones that stretch along the bonds. And so here you would have, imagine, towards two carbon atoms, they're trying to pull electrons out of the bond towards the positively charged nuclei. So those are the two basic pictures. And basically, the picture of bonds is, well, we're imagining electrons being pulled into the bond. If you have a compressive mode, so that's a negative eigenvalue, but it has a negative eigenvalue of small magnitude, so a negative eigenvalue that's close to zero, that indicates that it's very easy to sort of move this bond, say, up and down or side to side. It indicates an easy way to move a bond. And so intuitively, we would just expect these to have very flat electron density with sort of delocalized bonds. They aren't very directional. So that's the basic picture. I said in the other way, we imagine it to have delocalized electron density. And you can sort of, if you go through the gradient expansion for the stress tensor, I'm calling this the Bader stress tensor because there are an infinite number of different definitions of this stress tensor in the literature. This is only the kinetic component, which is what the chemists usually talk about. And this is just the standard one. It's the one that goes back to Schrodinger and Pauli, in fact. And here, you'll notice that there's a term that's proportional to the identity matrix, a term that is basically a rank one term depending on the gradient, and then there's a second derivative tensor of the electron density. And I've colored this term in this color because this obviously has no content, really. It's just a proportional to the identity matrix. If you're looking in the Bader picture at a bond critical point or any place where the gradient of the density is zero, that's where Bader would say you're right between two atoms. Well, in those places, then this term vanishes. And in fact, the motivation of this is that for at least 15 years, and 15 years computationally and 30 years theoretically, the atoms and molecules community has been looking at the second derivative matrix and trying to predict structural changes in materials. And they've looked at what would correspond to the highest negative eigenvalue of the second derivative matrix, and they've said this seems to point the way towards phase changes. And this is just a picture from a paper I wrote, but it's nothing new to me. And so the real puzzle was, why does this second derivative matrix actually seem to explain chemical changes? And I said, well, given that it can be thought of as a stress tensor, maybe that's sort of the way it works. And so I said, well, chemical changes to me mean breaking and forming bonds. I would be much more interested in breaking and forming bonds than just structural rearrangements where you're just doing sort of physical type changes. And so I looked at the stress tensor and the second derivative tensor for a lot of reactions. This one is for a keto enol tautomerization. And what you'll notice is the stress tensor here does seem, in fact, to sort of point the way that this hydrogen is going to follow over towards this carbon when it transfers over to form the keto form. The second derivative tensor doesn't do a very good job for these. It turns out that you'll notice that basically it just swaps certain directions every now and then, which is the price of an approximation, really. It's not exactly aligned, but it's pretty well aligned, and I'll quantify what I mean by pretty well aligned just a little bit later. Just to let you know, when we go all along the reaction path, we sort of keep this picture constant where we see, remember, this is just an eigenvector, so it can point in either direction. We see this proton, again, trying to go towards the hydrogen atom. At the transition state, you can't say anything because you have bond paths connecting hydrogen to oxygen and hydrogen to carbon. At the force maximum, again, all you can sort of see is you're breaking a plane. So there's sort of, at some point, this is useful. It's not nearly as useful as it is in solids. I'll admit, I thought it was a negative result. I'm not too enthusiastic about it. For the looking at structural changes as opposed to chemical reactions, the stress tensor seems to work much well. As for whether you can get away with using the second derivative tensor, it turns out that if you look at the absolute error or the relative error relative to the second derivative tensor, all I've done is just said, well, there's some identity matrix term, and this term, this factor of 12 is very debatable. This is one of the major factors that changes when you use different formulas for the stress tensor. And so basically it turns out that this stress tensor and this matrix, the second derivative matrix scaled and shifted by an identity, looks a lot the same, small absolute errors, about 5% at most relative errors. This is just at different points on the reaction path that I'm seeing, and it's basically okay everywhere along the reaction path. That tells you when you see the two arrows pointing in different directions is because they're nearly degenerate, which is what you expect. And that's sort of the story on that. Now I'm going to sort of totally shift gears, and I'll talk about some energy decomposition analysis type things. This is similar to what Professor Bilkelhop talked about this morning. It's a little bit of a different goal, because we wanted to decompose the interaction energy, but we only wanted to use the electron density to do it. And basically, I'm going to sort of walk through this scheme very slowly and sort of justify the choices we made, because they are choices, right? There's no right way to do energy decomposition analysis. There are lots of different choices, and you make the ones that make the most sense to you. This is something that hopefully at the end you'll think is at least not crazy. So we start with the energy of the isolated fragments. That's our reference. You have to define those references somehow. I mean, that's no computer will give you the starting reference. That's your brain. And we'll compute the densities and the Fukui functions, which is just the way that the densities change when you add or subtract electrons to the system. And these are sort of exact expressions if you were doing this at the full CI level. They're approximate if you're doing them at the DFT level. And then the first step is exactly the same step that I think everyone does, which is you say, well, these isolated fragments, in fact, they don't have the right geometry. If you take a methyl radical, then it doesn't have the same geometry as the methyl group within a molecule. So you have to deform it. And that's all this is saying, is that you just take the difference between the reference geometries and the optimized geometries within the molecule. And we call that the preparation energy, just like everyone else does. Where we start to change things a little bit is where we start defining the steric energy or the Pauli repulsion. And so we take the promolecular spin density, so we add up all the fragment densities, and we force them to all have all their spins paired. And so we're just going to take the densities, we aren't going to let the densities change at all, and we just add them up, and then we can find the energy associated with that density. So how do you do that? Well, this is something that people in this community well know. There's a Van Leeuwen-Behrens method of doing it. There's the Zhao Marsden-Parr method of doing it. There's the Wu Yang method of doing it. If you give us a density, we can give you back the energy at a DFT level. If you want to do something that Andreas has done, Andreas Savin has done, you could even do it at the ab initio level. So if you give us a density, we can give you back the energy. That's just a standard trick in DFT. So now you have all the fragments. They have exactly the sum of the fragment densities. So the densities have not changed at all. Now we say, well, we'll let the spin densities change, but we won't let the total densities change. And that sort of simulates the way that you can have electrons pairing. And so now we'll let the densities can't change at all. Therefore, you can't have electron transfer. You can't have polarization. But nonetheless, you are sort of measuring by looking at all the spins aligned, so two molecules like this, the two molecules like this, you're looking at the pairing energy. That's the next piece of this. And then this is where we ran into problems, and I'll try to explain why there's problems here. So there are two ways that we thought about doing this at first, and really I should owe Patrick Boltink a thanks, because it was when I was talking to him and pointing out there were two ways that he told me there has to be a better way than if there are two ways. The first way is you could say, I'm going to compute the polarization energy first. So I will now minimize the energy of the fragments. I'll let the fragments change, but I won't let the population of the fragments change. And this is something that you can do with a trick that Wu and Van Voorhis has figured out. And then at this stage, you have polarized fragments with no electron transfer because the atomic populations haven't changed. And then your last step is electron transfer. So you take your total energy, you subtract off the previous step, and that's the electron transfer. However, you could do it opposite. You could say, well, here's the fragment. I'll go to the populations in the final molecule by just adding on the way electrons would transfer in the isolated system. That's what this is. So you make the fragments have the right charge, but you are always using an isolated system density, and therefore there's no polarization. And then this would be an electron transfer, and then the rest of it would be polarization. So what do you do? How do you choose between these two? And really, it's a very deep issue in the sense that it has to do with the arbitrariness of atoms and molecules in general. Because I can imagine lithium hydride as lithium plus an H minus, but I can also imagine as lithium plus H neutral, where the lithium atom has an electron density that looks like this. And the lithium atom has a hump over near the hydrogen. There's nothing wrong with that. One way you have a lot of polarization, and one way you have a lot of charge transfer. The two are interchangeable. So the only way I know to make it so that it doesn't matter which order you do it is you do it in lots of different steps. So you optimize the densities at a fixed charge, and then you let a tiny bit of electron transfer happen. And then you optimize the electron densities at the new charge, a tiny little bit of electron transfer happen, so on and so forth. Iteratively, enough steps so that it doesn't matter, right? That's a sensible way of defining this. Then you add up all the polarization contributions, all the electron transfer contributions. That's the basic way this works. Here's a figure from our first paper on this. And this is just the water dimer. And it's maybe not the most interesting example. We don't have any bonds breaking or forming. I like it, though, because it says something about what you should and should not trust in your molecular dynamics simulations, because you'll notice that there's quite a bit of charge transfer energy and quite a bit of polarization energy. And when we simulate with molecular dynamics water, say, we usually don't have any polarization or any charge transfer. You might have a little bit of polarization. This is just the water dimer. If you put anything else in solution, say an anion, a cation, even a different type of solvent molecule, this will get a lot worse. Right? This is sort of the best possible case. Everything in the system has the same electronegativity. It's just the orientation of the two water molecules that's different, and you still have, you know, a chemical size error in the charge transfer. And so finally, I'm going to talk a little bit about what I'll call density-based population analysis. And the motivation for this is almost something I've already alluded to, which is that population analysis is sort of incredibly arbitrary. And I would say there's no such thing as a black box population analysis method, in the sense that any population analysis method you give me, I am fairly confident that I can break it. If I can't break it, I'll give it to Patrick Boltink, and he will break it. And we have, basically as a goal, because at least for me, I'm very interested in sort of MM-type things and force field-type things, I would like to have a population analysis method that resembles these electrostatic fitting charges. But electrostatic fitting charges are really bad when you have a buried charge. So a metal atom surrounded by bulky ligands, it's hard to get the charge on the metal. And I would like something that resembles it when electrostatic fitting works, but however I can use for other types of chemistry. And here's just a series of references related to various aspects of this. So this started back when I was actually in graduate school, and Bob Parra and Roman Nalivosky were sitting down one day, and Roman has always been very fond of entropy type things, and he just said, suppose I take the sum of the entropies of the atoms referenced to the reference atoms, so neutral atoms, say. And then if you look at this, basically what you're asking is try to make the atoms in a molecule, they have to add up to the molecular density, but they should resemble the atoms in the periodic table as much as possible. So you do this, you optimize, and this is the only role that I had in this initial work, was that then they came to me and they said, we found this wonderful new population analysis scheme, and I scratched my chin and said, you just rederived Hirschfeld. Right? And this is exactly the Hirschfeld scheme, but a rederivation of the Hirschfeld scheme. The problem is, what do you choose for the atomic charges? I mean, if you have lithium fluoride and you use neutral atoms, you'll get one answer. If you use lithium plus and fluorine minus, you'll get a different answer. What's right? And this is something that Patrick Boltink really drove. And he said, well, the obvious thing is, I will get the charges out of this, and then I'll put them back in, and I'll have fractionally charged atoms. And then I'll take those, and I'll put them back in, and I'll get fractionally charged atoms again. And I keep doing that until it's self-consistent, if you like. And the charges you get out are the same as the charges you get in. And that really works amazingly well. here's just the electrostatic fitting. So we take electrostatic potential, we take the one that's produced by the charges, and we take the one that's produced by the actual calculation, the full electron density. This is what you get from electrostatic fitting. This is what you get from Hirschfeld I, so this iterative Hirschfeld method. You'll notice that these two are really very close. It's worse. If you look, here's the electrostatic fitting. This is averaged over a big set of molecules. Hirschfeld I is about twice as big, but it's much better by at least a factor of two than the conventional types of population analysis you use. So in this sense, I wouldn't claim that Hirschfeld I is optimal. I don't believe in optimal atomic populations. However, I would say that it does a good job for what we wanted, which is resembles electrostatic fitting. That said, there's a huge number of families of different things you can do like this. So one way of saying is, instead of iterating like this, why don't I, since I'm trying to minimize this information anyway, why don't I just minimize this information by adjusting the atomic population? So we don't iterate to convergence. Instead, we just choose the best atomic populations. And we do choose those atomic populations to minimize the information. It turns out that's equivalent to choosing a sum of atomic densities that resembles the true molecular density as much as possible in an information theoretic sense. And so this is a totally equivalent scheme to that. A little bit of math to show that. In general, when you do this, the reference atoms aren't the same as the atomic fragment. So now you have something different, but you do have a smaller entropy. You have a smaller information loss relative to the fragments. And you can think of this, but not the others, as really optimizing the promolecular density. So there's several different ways to do this then. What I just told you would be just maximize, if you like, the similarity or minimize the information that's lost from the promolecular towards the molecule. Hirschfeld would just take the atomic populations, don't change them. The Hirschfeld I, it turns out, you can imagine it in the same context, but when you do this minimization, you constrain the minimization such that the atomic populations are the same as the atom in a molecule populations are the same as the reference approximations. And if you do that in the outer loop, you get one scheme. If you do it in the inner loop, you get a different scheme. This different scheme, I think we'll submit a paper on this very soon. It's not great, and it's really computationally painful. Why outer loop is so much better than inner loop, I don't know. But there are lots of other flavors of this. You could say, well, instead of doing this optimization, I want to use a symmetric. We call this a divergence. It's not a distance. If you try to use the distance between densities, it doesn't work. You don't get a unique population analysis from the distance. But with this divergence you do, you could say, well, this isn't symmetric between the two atomic densities, so let me symmetrize it, and that gives you what they call the symmetric divergence. Or you could say, I'm going to take an arbitrary weighting of the atom with respect to the reference and the reference with respect to the atom. That would give you a different scheme. You could do something that DFT people will like, using the square roots of the densities. That's sort of a nice norm. It's the norm we use in DFT to define inrepresentability, for example. You could use the Salas or Renyi information, which are generalizations of this Kullback-Leibler. All of these you can do. And if you do them, you'll find that you don't get very different results. This is just the reactant, so this reactant complex, very much like Professor Buckelhaupt was talking about for an SN2 reaction. And what you'll notice is that in general, the Hirschfeld charges are, or the Hirschfeld I charges are bigger than the Hirschfeld charges. That's a very, very general scheme. And then these other sorts of charges are vaguely reminiscent. You can't, at least I can't, by looking at this table, say this is better, this is worse. They're all sort of semi-chemically reasonable. There is a neat feature, which is something that Professor Nalivosky, Professor Parr, and myself developed, which is that if you use this logarithmic approach, you can break this into a term that looks like an entropy of mixing and a term that looks like a polarization. This is now the shape function. It's normalized to 1. Yeah. And because it's normalized to 1, it's a nice probability distribution function. Technically, when you evaluate an information, you should always make sure that the normalization of your reference and the normalization of your distribution is the same. So this lets you decompose things into two fragments and that's exactly what we can do. Here's a different state. This is a transition state of an SN2 reaction now. And the first thing you'll notice is that the charges in this transition state with respect to different this Kolbach-Leibler, so this optimization method versus the Hirschfeld I, they're the same to numerical precision, in fact. And what you'll also notice is there's essentially no electron transfer. This minus 7 times 10 to the minus 4, it's technically has to be non-negative quantity. This is literally the error in the computation. So these two are the same up to numerical accuracy for this system, and they're often very close to the same. And if I had to guess why Hirschfeld I works so well, it might be because a lot of the times it's very close to actually the optimal charges. It's extremely close to this sort of variationally stability point. Just to quickly run through, we can do this along a reaction path. You get sort of intuitive results. Here's just an SN2 reaction, a non-symmetric reaction. One thing that Alejandro Torralbe likes to do is differentiate this, and then he would claim that most of the electronic structure changes happen between the force maximum, because the derivative of the energy is a force, and the force minimum. So we expect most of the electronic structure changes to be in this region. So most of the charge transfer should also be in that region. And I've just starred where the boundaries of this region on these plots. And what you notice is things look more or less like you would think. Here the bromine is giving up charges. You'll notice again that the Hirschfeld charge is always less negative than the actual Hirschfeld I charge. In this case, they don't differ that much. The carbon atom is a significantly more negative in Hirschfeld I, and you notice it goes up towards neutrality at the middle. I'm going to skip the next one, which is the hydrogens and the chlorines, and just give you a look at the actual, here's the carbon atom, and what you'll notice is that the entropy here dips way down. Now, you're going to think it's crazy that the total entropy is negative, but the reason the total entropy is negative here is there's actually an extra term that isn't put in, which has to do with the fact the reference has n electrons because it's neutral, and the actual molecule is a minus 1 electron. So there's a constant term that has to be put into this if you want to make everything right. I'm not worrying about a constant at this stage. The shapes of these are exactly right. And this mixing and polarization, in fact, gives you something sort of what you expect. You'll notice that the mixing is sort of dying down in the middle, which is what I expect because I expect the carbon to sort of look more neutral in the middle. And I can do the same thing for Hirschfeld I. In this case, there is no mixing by definition because the charge is preserved all along the path. And what you see here is that the molecules become significantly sort of more resembling the isolated atom at the transition state than when it's actually firmly bonded to something, which again is intuitive. I can do the same thing for the bromine atom, but it isn't so interesting probably. And what I'll just do is go through the conclusion. And I think the main conclusion is using only the density without any sort of Slater determinant type restriction, you can actually do a lot in terms of understanding chemical reactions and interactions. You can do this electronic stress tensor, which, as many of you know, I'm at McMaster, which means I have to do some atoms and molecules. This is my atoms and molecules. You can do this purely density-based energy decomposition. One nice thing about this is it could be extended to any electronic structure method in any number of fragments. There's no problem with that. And finally, these sort of Hirschfeld population analyses with these associated entropies give us sort of a different tool in our toolbox that I like, but we're still exploring.
Thank you very much for this interesting talk. The talk is open for discussion, but a very short discussion. We are a little over the schedule, please.
This is what happens when you give the siesta talk.
Thanks. Then let us. Oh, there is a question, please.
In that case, when you have the different definitions of information entropy, like solids, rain, etc.,
yep.
Did you do a correlation between atomic charges over the big set of molecules that you showed in the early beginning?
No, we haven't done a a statistical test. We have put about 20 of them on a plot. And the answer is they aren't exactly the same. This is sort of the best case. It's just the case I happen to have. They are quite close. I would say that the trends are exactly the same. The correlation between those is closer than the correlation between Hirschfeld I and any of the methods that you consider the full set for.
Thank you. Let us thank again the speaker.